Welcome to the Real Vision Daily Briefing. It's Monday, January 24th, 2022. I'm Ash Bennington, joined today by Real Vision's own Weston Nakamura. A lot going on to discuss today with Weston. Geopolitical instability driving volatility across asset classes, global equities selling off. But then at the end of the day, it looks like we're in green territory, positive territory on all U.S. equity indexes. A striking day. Crypto also continuing to get hammered. We're going to talk more about this. This all comes in the wake of rising tensions between Russia and Ukraine in Eastern Europe. Much to talk about today with Weston Nakamura. Weston, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, sir. How are you, Ash? What are you doing in my place?
I'm trying not to get whiplash from U.S. equity markets.
Okay. Good luck avoiding that. Pretty wild day.
Obviously, a lot going on today. Wild day, wild week. What do you see? What are you looking at? Most important, tell us your view.
Okay. So, the Fed obviously is, you know, right upon us. What is happening in the markets in terms of this risk, the risk off at least, especially today? This is not the Fed. This is by and large driven by, as you just mentioned, what is happening geopolitically in Ukraine. The reason I say that is very simply, if you look at two charts, I have them, I tweeted them out earlier, but one is if you just look at a chart of the euro ruble, and you just throw that on top of the S&P 500, or you have to invert that, or you can just leave it as is and you throw it on top of the VIX, you'll see that they, intraday basis, they line up very, very closely. Another chart is that
So what this is showing, Weston, just so for people who aren't as familiar with macro and global markets as you are, so what this is showing essentially is when the Russian ruble is selling off against the euro, we're seeing that tracking exactly with what's happening in U.S. equity markets and also in the VIX. In other words, geopolitical tension rising, declines in U.S. equity markets.
Correct. Because, you know, If Putin and company, if they invade Ukraine, and then you're starting to get a lot of, you know, a lot of kind of aggressive hawkish talk out of the Biden administration and out of UK as well. But there's just a lot of uncertainty, you know, around there. But they're going to hit them. They're going to hit Russia with sanctions and this and that. And it's going to be a very ruble negative. So euro ruble, that's going to trade down. You see it trading sharply. Euro ruble trading sharply higher, and that corresponds in line with the price action of the S&P 500. Also, if you just look at the equity markets from a global open to close, so starting from my side of the planet with the Nikkei from the DM markets, the Nikkei opened down something like 1.25%, but it basically just rallied all the way up and it closed in the green from being down 1.25%. Euro stocks, however, they opened down and they closed down like over 4%, not just SX 5E, but the DAX, the CAC, they all just closed on a straight line down. And then during that overlap period, you see the US open, you see equities get pulled down during US cash hours until Europe markets close, at which point US stocks rebound after being dragged down by Europe, and they close green. So what's happening is it's Europe that is and the European geopolitical risk that is pulling global risk assets down.
Talk a little bit about that. Give us your framework for thinking about why we're seeing declines in European equities as a consequence of this geopolitical instability.
I guess it would be a very, very long time, certainly I guess within my lifetime, sort of this Western alliance, but leaderless Western alliance, and it's certainly the first kind of major geopolitical conflict within the Biden administration, right? Absent an Angela Merkel and all of these sort of a vacuum of leadership, or at least conflicting leadership. I mean, you have you know, net gas, you have Putin with leverage over that, over Europe, you know, you have the winter, you have China involved, basically. We have Xi Jinping saying, do not start, like, invading countries heading into the Olympics. We are going to have a global orderly Olympics. Putin cannot wait until the end of the Olympics because it'll start to get warm out and he will have no longer have his net gas leverage. Like, there's so many, like, you know, different parts that are, you know, that each any one of them could be a source of major sort of uncertainty and volatility in and of itself. Yeah. So versus like the Fed, which everyone knows what they're gonna cut rates.
Let me just add three quick data points here around what's happening in Ukraine right now in Eastern Europe. So first of all, the Russo-Ukrainian war has been an ongoing conflict. Over 10,000 people have already unfortunately died in that war that began in 2014. The fear now, the concern is that there is going to be a large-scale invasion of Ukraine by Russia. That's the worry. That's the concern. That's particularly troubling because Ukraine borders Romania and Poland, both of which are within the NATO alliance, part of the Article 5 mutual protection agreement, meaning that this has direct geopolitical impact vis-a-vis the United States and Western allies. And finally, reporting today by the New York Times that President Biden is considering putting U.S. troops into the region, and that is obviously something that is potentially a direct involvement for the United States. Again, this is being reported by the New York Times. It has not been confirmed by the White House. So that's just the general framework. Weston, you transitioned there a little bit to talk about what's happening more broadly in the macroeconomic sphere with inflation and the Fed. Give us a sense of what your thinking is there.
Regarding the Fed for this upcoming FOMC policy, or?
Well, yeah, you essentially said that you think that the risk is baked in. I would sort of say, look, the Fed is having problems right now on both sides of the mandate, the dual mandate. You have effectively CPI at higher rates than we've seen at any point in the last 40 years. This is considerable inflationary pressure. While meanwhile, at the same time, while we've seen a kind of baseline recovery on the unemployment rate, we're still negative 3.6 million jobs dating back to February of 2020 at the beginning of the COVID crisis. This is a challenging time for the Fed. Obviously, they've begun the taper. There's talk now about interest rate normalization in the wake of rising inflation and potentially unwinding the balance sheet. How do you parse all of these variables?
So I would say that, you know, I guess from the beginning of this year, you know, which is obviously not too long ago, certainly the sell side banks have kind of gotten into this competition of trying to out hawk each other with how many, you know, how hawkish the rate, you know, the Fed is going to be. And right now, you have markets pricing in, I think, 4 rate hikes. You have like a 50 basis point rate hike for March, and all that. I think that that is a little bit excessive in terms of not what they should do or anything like that, but what's actually going to, you know, transpire. And I think also that if the Fed doesn't deliver on a very, I guess, you know, super hawkish relative to how they've been, you know, in the last several years, super hawkish sort of message, or, you know, this week, then that's going to seriously, you know, kind of throw a whipsaw into markets and directionally. You know, you're probably not going to see like a full on risk on, but you're going to see like a lot of short covering and a lot of volatility, upside volatility, which is, you know, not any more pleasant than downside volatility. The one thing I'll also say too, regarding, you know, I mean, there's obviously a lot of cross asset sort of correlations, but Brian, if you actually pull up this chart of Eurodollar futures versus Bitcoin. So the last time I was on the daily briefing, Maggie had asked me about, you know, do FOMC, you know, does a hawkish Fed have like any impact on Bitcoin? And basically what I said was no, because Bitcoin traders probably don't really care about you know, FOMC sort of expectations. And what I was referring to in my defense was like dot plots and all that kind of thing. But nonetheless, I looked into it like, you know, later that day. Turns out I was very, very wrong. So December 22 euro dollar futures, that's the orange, okay? They actually do trade very much in line with Bitcoin spot. And that's kind of a more of a recent phenomenon. And, you know, if you look at the bottom part of the chart, that's kind of zoomed in for like a year to date, you know, last few days or so. And you'll see that they kind of like kind of trade inverse for a little bit. But then like starting at the beginning of the year when the volume drops off, after the volume picks up again, they really just kind of lock into place. So you can, you might see a situation in which right now euro dollar futures are pricing in, like I said, a very kind of hawkish Fed. And if the Fed, for whatever reason, because risk assets have sold off a lot or whatever it is, but if they aren't as hawkish as the market is kind of positioned for, and euro dollar futures start to trade upwards, and you know that might actually put at least a temporary floor under or stop the momentum under risk assets, including Bitcoin and S&P and other things too. So
those declining euro dollar futures inversely correlated with the rate. In other words, those are showing a hawkish tightening stance being priced into euro dollar futures markets by the Fed.
Yeah. So when those trade down, that's basically rate hikes, the right. Fed funds rates, you know, front end rates being pulled up.
We're going to take a quick break and be right back with more of the day's top analysis on the Real Vision Daily Briefing.
Hi, everybody. I'm Katie Segal.
And I'm Kurt Sutter.
And welcome to our new podcast called PI, People, Influences, and Experiences.
Yes, it's sort of the get to know you at a deeper level, the who, what, when, where, and why you are, rather than what it is you do.
Absolutely. We're not going to talk too much about what people do. We just want to know about their families, where they come from, you know, what shapes their parenting if they have kids, what shapes their marriages if they're married. We just want to be really nosy. We want to get in there.
A deep dive into nature and nurture.
And we started it because there are a lot of people that we don't know that we are curious about.
All right. And I have no friends. So for me, it's, you know.
Trying to get them out of the house.
Listen to it on whatever you listen to podcasts on.
Yeah, podcast, homecast.
Your podcasting apparatus. Watch it on the YouTube.
He's aging himself.
Yeah. Weston, by the way, much to talk about here with Bitcoin and crypto, but while we're talking about the Fed, while we're talking about inflation, I wanted to turn to an interview on Real Vision today. This is an interview between Rob Arnott interviewing the economist John Cochran, a piece called Why Chronic Misdiagnosis Will Lead to Persistent Inflation. This is on the Essential, Pro, and Plus tier here at Real Vision. Let's take a look at the clip.
The other feature you should keep in mind is inflation is it's like a bank run. It's like stocks. The central mechanism of inflation is if we knew exactly inflation would be higher next year, then everyone would go out and raise prices now. We'd have inflation right now. And everyone would demand higher wages right now. And everyone would be willing to pay those higher prices right now. Just like stocks. If you knew stocks would be higher next year, you'd go out and buy them and they'd go up today. So inflation is inherently hard to predict. And a lot of the mechanism is like a bank run. It's like a crisis. If you knew there was going to be a bank run tomorrow, you'd go get your money today and out we go. Mm-hmm. So the way I think of it is inflation is like a fault line. It's like an earthquake fault. I live in California on an earthquake fault. Haven't had an earthquake fault in 10 years either, but that doesn't mean you shouldn't worry about one breaking up. To add to that, so this one was much larger. This is how Larry Summers got it right. He took out a back of an envelope. He said, my best guess of the GDP gap is, I forget his numbers, but I'll make some. My best guess of the GDP gap is about $2 trillion. They showered us with $5 trillion of money. Bing, there's going to be inflation. And Larry's back of the envelope said it was less last time. Also, last time there was credibly a lack of demand, if you want to use some simple term for why we had a recession. This time, a COVID crisis and lockdown is not a lack of demand. You can give people all the money you want. When there's a pandemic out, they're not going out to dinner. It's like a big snowstorm as far as the economy is concerned. So treating it with extra demand was simply a mistake. You had a supply shift. The economy is locked down. And it's not, the restaurants are not empty because people don't have enough money to buy things. The restaurants are empty because they're legally locked down and no one wants to go to them. So there's a fundamental misdiagnosis of the need for stimulus.
Well, there you have it, a fundamental misdiagnosis, this idea of 2.5 times the demand cap being put on fiscal policy stimulus. This sets up the case for structural inflation. Weston, you and I were talking a little bit as the clip was running about your thoughts on how to position for this scenario.
It's not really a position for this particular scenario, but so I actually have a trade in which to play this current market that I kind of want to share with the audience.
Walk us through it.
This is not trading advice. Here's a disclaimer. If you listen to me, you will lose money because this is a very bad idea. That's as clear as I can get. Okay.
I've never heard that disclaimer before.
Yeah, that's as clear as if you want to use me as a reverse indicator, you'll still somehow lose money. So just don't listen. Now it's very dangerous for me to at least just be outright short anything. The unlimited upside and the limited upside and unlimited downside is not an appealing risk reward. I like to do pair trades, market neutral pair trades, where you short something, you take the proceeds and you go long something, and therefore you actually don't have any sort of out of pocket, capital outlay. And if you do it sort of directionally, market neutral, then you actually reduce your volatility. So a way that I've been playing, the downside, for like NASDAQ for tech, US tech, for example, is that I've been taking advantage of this Sony sell-off. So Sony sold off because Microsoft, put a bid for ATVI at, $95 per share. And that basically just crushed Sony shares. Sony had its worst single day drop since October of 2008. October of 2008, when Lehman, destroyed the world. Because Microsoft went long Call of Duty and the metaverse. So seems like a lot of, basically every sort of bad news is kind of currently priced into Sony. And that sets up for a really interesting, pair trade in which you can go long Sony and short. I actually used the tech sector ETF. So if you look at Brian, if you go to the first chart, is that up already? Yeah. So basically what you have here is Sony is a Japanese company. It trades, in the Tokyo Stock Exchange. So basically I have both the ADR and 6758 Sony up. And what you see here is this huge drop, led by the US, but then you see this enormous drop further, during Japan hours, and basically Sony gets crushed because of Japanese panic selling. That was sort of this kind of opportunity for me to do this pair trade. So second chart is go to the second chart, Brian. This is same thing versus the Nikkei, and you can see the Nikkei has not been doing well. It's down 4% all that time, but you can see how badly Sony got crushed. That makes it a great opportunity for you to go long this because, basically every sort of bad news is priced in from a single stock perspective as well as a broader, sell-off perspective. Third chart is, so these are basically the sort of the sectors. This is XLK is the ETF that I'm using to go short, but you could use the SOX Philadelphia Semiconductor ETF as well. And you'll see that Sony is just kind of just underperforming all of those. And then the next chart, this is the actual long short. So this is since I put it on, this is just about 2 days ago. Sony has kind of recovered a little bit. XLK is down 5%. This was before today's open. And this pair trade, this market neutral pair trade is up about 6% right now as we speak. And then next chart is This is since the March 2020 sell-off, and you'll see that Sony actually does track XLK quite well. This is why I chose it, but it is not a member of XLK. However, many of its competitors are in it, so it makes it sort of a perfect sort of, you know, long-short setup. And then final chart is, let's see, what is the final chart? Again, this is just the pair trade. So this is a way that you could actually, this is not a long Sony trade or anything like that. This is more so a short, you know, SPX tech, but you could do it hedged because Sony has just been crushed and sold off. And not because, not in the way that Peloton did and not the way that Netflix did. Those are fundamental to those specific, you know, companies. This is because of a, you know, a takeover that might not even go through. I think Microsoft offered $95 per share. Activision never even got up. I think it got up to like 86. So even Activision shareholders aren't really believing, aren't buying it or selling it in this case. So this is, you know, just sort of a way that you can hedge a short position, play the downside, and really, you know, you're kind of market neutral directionally, and you're you know, neutralizing a lot of the volatility as well, and then you're neutralizing the cost. So this is just something I have on. It's probably short term. If Sony reports earnings in the beginning of February, if the stock pops, like it has times a lot in the last several earnings, I'm gonna have to take off the trade, which is kind of unfortunate because I want to play more of the downside if that should continue. But that's basically a way that you can sort of think about playing the downside for situations like this. Because this is not like an actual sell-off. This is not like some gamma flip or some, you know, like mechanical like March 2020 sort of situation. This is an actual orderly sell-off that's taking place right now. So,
yeah, really interesting, Weston. Always a pleasure to take a look at those charts, look at your correlations. Fascinating stuff. By the way, talking about sell-offs, we mentioned earlier in the show a couple of times, actually, what's happening right now in cryptocurrency. I want to jump in here a little bit. Actually, while we've been talking, it looks like Bitcoin up over 37,000. I'm looking right now on CoinGecko. It's really interesting to see the volatility in this asset class. Let me give a little bit of context here of what we're looking at and a little bit of the historical framework. And there it goes, about below 37,000, 36,956. So it's hovering right around that level. What does that mean in terms of where we are relative to 52-week highs? We're off right now about 46% on Bitcoin. On Ethereum, we're down around 49%, 49.5%, so just a shade under off 50%. Obviously, these are significant moves. People who have invested in this, particularly near local highs, experiencing a lot of pain right now. And we don't want to minimize that, of course, but I also want to give a little bit of context for these price movements and what we're seeing here. Max drawdowns from this peak looking close to 50% on both of these assets. Here's a little bit of context, Weston. You may find this interesting. November 2011, max drawdown 92%. January 2015, this is on Bitcoin. January 2015, max drawdown on Bitcoin 84% or thereabouts. I just eyeballed this on a max drawdown chart earlier. December 2018, minus 83% drawdown in Bitcoin. March 2020, minus 71% in Bitcoin from previous peak. July 2021, off 50%. So what we're seeing here actually is obviously a very highly volatile asset class. As with all volatile assets, the challenges are, as Raul has pointed out before, people who have excessive leverage, excessive risk-taking in terms of putting on too much exposure to a given asset or a given asset class get absolutely hammered. But in the general context of what we're looking at for volatility for max drawdown, this actually is showing a pattern of higher lows.
Yeah, and lower highs on realized volatility as well.
And higher highs on price, obviously, considerably.
Yep. So 1 month realized vol at 50. This used to be at 400 realized. Yeah. Look, I mean, the Turkish lira is more volatile than Bitcoin.
That's by the way,
but you know.
Listen, by the way, what does this tell you about the price of Bitcoin tomorrow, next week, next month? absolutely nothing. And that's the important point, I think. But look, in the broader context, this is why I'm so interested in this asset class. I've been watching software for a very long time, particularly fintech. I've been doing fintech stuff since before they called it fintech. I was a tech consultant when I was barely old enough to drink legally. You know, back in my early 20s, when I was working on Wall Street, I was actually at Credit Suisse in April of 2000. This was the month that the NASDAQ collapsed and the so-called dot-com dot-bomb collapse. I remember I went up to the trading floor that day because I knew it was a historic moment and I wanted to see it and I wanted to be there and I wanted to be part of it because I knew it would be something to remember. Here's the reality. We didn't stop using email. We didn't stop using the internet because the NASDAQ sold off. I think so too with what's happening in digital assets here. I don't get up on a soapbox a lot on Real Vision Daily Briefing, but I want to talk about why this is something that I'm incredibly passionate about. My conviction is that these distributed networks that use the properties of mathematics and the laws of physics to secure the transfer of value, identity, and trust on the web has a profound implication for the way that communication gets done, for the way that business gets done, for the way that we communicate. I think we're still seeing a profound shift. Price volatility, 50% loss, doesn't change any of that. I'm curious, Weston, how do you think about what's happening in the digital asset space? Do you look at it purely as a technical risk asset, or do you think about some of the more other implications more broadly?
I mean, I can't follow that. Are you kidding me? In all seriousness, yeah. So, okay, I have a core long position that I just have stored away that I don't touch. In addition to that, I proactively trade Bitcoin because it's fun to trade, and because when I trade it, I understand it more. And I, at the end of the day, I am a price action person. And yes, it is volatile, but and of course, it's a risk asset because, you know, like you and I were discussing before, especially with, you know, Ethereum and sort of the layer twos, you're pulling forward. So like what you're saying, like, you know, in terms of like the future and all that, you're pulling forward so much of this like future upside, which I believe is there. But because of that, of course, it's going to be a risk asset and not a store of, you know, stability or some low vol sort of store value or medium of exchange or anything like that. With respect to, you know, again, like the Solanas or insert any sort of, you know, but yeah, at the end of the day, like, yeah, this is, we're talking about a decade and change for an entire asset class. We've never seen an asset class being born out of, you know, from scratch before. Nobody has that's currently alive, you know, and for that reason alone, I don't care really what your opinion is of it. You need to at least be involved just so you can understand what it's like to have a brand new asset class enter the menu of asset classes, which doesn't change normally. You know, it's fixed income, equities, currencies, commodities, and then something else. So,
Weston, you followed it brilliantly. I love this idea of demand being pulled forward. That's a perfect way to think about it, I think. This idea that there's a lot of future potential from these networks, that demand basically gets pulled forward, reflected in the price. Of course, there's going to be volatility. Makes perfect sense to me.
We're going to take another quick break and be right back with more of the day's top analysis on the Real Vision Daily Briefing.
Welcome to another round of Boardroom or Miro Board. Today we talk retrospectives with Agile coach Maria. Let's go. First question. You've spent 2 hours in a team retro, but the only input you've heard is Dave's. Boardroom or Miro Board?
Boardroom. In Miro, Dave can't hog the space because everyone can add thoughts anonymously, online, at the same time.
Correct. Next. You need the team to act on feedback fast, so you turn all those retro notes into Jira tasks instantly.
Miro all the way. And I can assign those tasks to teammates.
You're nailing this. Now, you see hundreds of sticky notes from the retro. A real mess. But you organize them into 5 themes in just seconds.
Miro, I basically get back an entire hour when I use its AI tools for clustering.
And she's done it.
Join over 60 million people running actually enjoyable and actionable retros in Miro. Get your first 3 boards free at Miro.com. That's Miro.com.
by the way, I know we could talk about this all day, but we've got a lot of questions coming in for you that I wanted to hit. The first one, well, let's take a look. This one comes to us from Andre Ventenhouse from YouTube. And the question is, what do you think about the position of China? ! What's your take on what's happening in China right now?
The position of China or taking a position in China?
He's phrased it the position of China. So I think he's talking broadly about the structure of some of the things that you've reflected on with regard to some of the potential for debt and leverage challenges in China.
Okay, so I put out a video about this last week. So last week, you'll see that the market sold off every single day except for one day where the Hang Seng Index rallied 3.5%, led by the property sector and by the Meituans, the Alibabas, and so on and so forth. And that was because China actually cut, finally, the right rate, which was the five-year LPR, which is the rate that targets mortgages. And so this was the first time that China has signaled that they're going to be using monetary policy to actually support, or at least not like, you know, continue to hammer down on the property sector during this deleveraging campaign. And that's what rallied risk assets. So there might be a turning point there. I do have a very kind of controversial.
This is the prime rate, Weston, is that right? Loan prime rate.
Right. Yeah, they've cut that before in December, but that was 1-year loan prime rate that applies more to corporates. They did that to highlight the fact that they're not touching the 5-year. This time they actually cut the 5-year, which applies to mortgages. My very controversial sort of idea that I'm just going to throw out there, and I don't really care what the feedback or blowback is going to be, is so COVID zero COVID, China's policy. What I will say about that is that I think that China is very aware that it's economically damaging, and I also think that they're very aware that it doesn't work. And so why are they doing this? Well, they're doing it, first of all, because they've done it for so long that they're stuck with it. They can't, you know, not do it anymore. But also, it's a very convenient sort of way to, or coincidental or otherwise, to basically not have uprisings and protests and things like, you know, social unrest and gangs, because if there is some sort of a corporate induced populist sort of anger against the, you know, the Levergrandes or the property sector as a whole, or you know, whatever it may be,
you're just calling it Levergrande now. You're always just going to have that L on the front.
They deserve it. And so, you know, if the government like cracks down on those protests, those gatherings, then they are going to be seen as kind of sticking up for the corporate elite, and that can't happen because then the pitchforks will turn on them. So this is a way for them to disperse the crowd, right? And I mean, if you just ask Hong Kong protesters in 2019, I mean, they wouldn't quit for anything except this pandemic, and I think Beijing noticed. So I think COVID zero is providing this very nice sort of side effect beneficiary of allowing them to exert their, you know, kind of lockdown or their suppressing of mass gatherings in the name of COVID and all that.
Yeah. Weston, changing gears here. This is a question for you from James Fox. This comes from the Exchange, that's Real Vision's internal social network here. And the question is, what do you think of the idea that Bitcoin price is leading the stock market?
Is leading?
Yeah.
What does that mean in terms of?
I think he's suggesting that the sell-off in digital assets precipitated a decline in U.S. and potentially global equity markets. I think like that's the nature of the question.
Okay. What do I make of it? I mean, I think that that's... Look, Bitcoin is just another... I don't want to say just another, but it is currently behaving in the same way as global risk assets. And sometimes one will lead another. And so right now, at this particular hour, with U.S. markets, cash equity markets closed, yeah, it's going to lead the futures market. So, I mean, I don't really make anything particularly of it. I would say look at BTC JPY and look at round levels on that. And you can see my tweets all about that as well. But just keep a close eye on, you know, like the 4 million yen level. And it's you know, make sure that like clears that or doesn't.
Yeah, this is a fascinating idea, looking at Bitcoin priced in yen. You've shown some strong correlations in some of the charts that you've tweeted before. Final question, Weston. This one comes to us from Lothar M. from the exchange. Do you think the exciting NFL games lifted U.S. futures on Sunday evening? I think we may have lost Weston. I don't know the answer to that question, but I will tell you it raises some serious questions about the overtime rule. And man, Patrick Mahomes is great. Mahomes is great to watch play. I hope he invests in Bitcoin so we can interview him on Real Vision. I'm not sure if we were able to get Weston back. I wanted to give him the last word, but I think we're having some technical problems. So I just wanted to thank you again for watching the Real Vision Daily Briefing. Alfonso will be here tomorrow with Tony Greer. And as always, the conversation continues on Real Vision's The Exchange. Thanks for watching, everybody.